Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hi, this is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Hello, everyone, and welcome once again to the Tennis Podcast, day 9 of Wimbledon Relived. A very special one indeed, hopefully a very special one indeed, a match that I think pretty much everyone that's had even the most passing interest in tennis at any stage of their life is probably aware of, one of the most dramatic and iconic Wimbledon finals of all time between the world number 125 at the time, the wild card and three-time beaten finalist Goran Ivanišević, and the losing finalist from the previous year and two-time US Open champion Pat Rafter. It's 2001, of course. 2001 is where we were yesterday as well, but I've got new facts, David.
No way.
There are no lengths that I won't go to make this podcast excellent.
I mean, you had about 12 facts yesterday. Yeah. What else happened?
I should say we've also spoken to both finalists, Goran Ivanišević, Pat Rafter, as well as Charlie Eccleshare that was there that day, and Ivan Ljubicic. So we've got that too. But more importantly than all of it, let's find out some other things that weren't worthy of going in the podcast the first time round that happened in 2001. George Bush was sworn in as the 43rd president of the United States. Silvio Berlusconi won re-election in Italy, so big year for right-wing heads of state. The International Olympic Committee awarded Beijing the 2008 Summer Olympics. Charles Ingram won £1 million on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire before having it snatched from him and being accused of cheating and later fraud. And Reading lost in the Division Two playoffs to Walsall 3-2 in extra time at the Millennium Stadium, and I was there.
Well, that's all right, because I'm from Walsall, so quite pleased about that.
Right, okay. Were you there? No.
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 But my granddad was a director,
I dragged my dad all the way to Cardiff for that. It was those were the Pardew years. There's no need to dwell on that.
It's a bit like Goran and Rafter, though, isn't it? Sort of, there's no loser there for the Tennis Podcast.
Is that true? That's definitely not how it felt either now or at the time. But anyway, we did go. We got automatic promotion the next year, so thank you, Alan Pardew, for that. Matt, do you remember this match? Are we in Matt's memory territory yet?
No, afraid not. I mean, I'm very, very aware of the match. This is probably the match before my time that I've watched the most, I would say, and I'm most aware of the stories surrounding it. But no, we're still in 2001, so we haven't really moved on in time from yesterday.
We've got a lot of audio for you today. We've just listened through all of it and decided, you know, we just want you to hear it all, because although it's a story that pretty much everybody in tennis is told at some stage, I don't know, some of what we've got for you today tells it a little bit differently, and perspectives that we've not heard before, David, and lines we've not heard before, despite being on the Champions Tour for about 8 decades between us and doing countless interviews with Goran and Pat and bigging up countless rematches of that famous 2001 final. How many press releases do you think we've written over the years, David, about a rematch between Goran and Pat? Several, yeah, I'd say several.
It's definitely into double figures. funny enough, when we were trying to work out how best to tell the story, we weren't actually planning to get Goran and Pat on a few weeks ago.
We thought, well, everyone's heard them tell it before. We thought, let's give a different take on it.
Yeah, and we've got a different take on it. But then a couple of days ago, somebody said, what about we try and get Rafter on? Because it would be interesting to hear his take. And let me tell you, it is. It's amazing when we've actually heard it. Way better than I expected. No offense, Pat. But then this last night, I ended up 2 a.m. I was supposed to watch the first four sets of the match. I ended up watching the lot whilst drinking at 2 a.m. and crying and watching it and thinking, I've got to find out what Goran was thinking at that moment and that moment. So this morning, gave him a call.
Name drop. Okay.
Sorry about that. Well, what can I do? I did.
Drinking whilst watching tennis at 1 a.m. sounds worryingly like Lost Law Years Mark II.
It's worth it. I tell you, I don't mind if I have a total regression right now. It was worth it.
You've also been speaking to Ivan Ljubicic, David, with whom you actually watched that final in a player's lounge in Gstaad. And we'll hear more about that experience later. But first of all, let's hear from Ivan Ljubicic, obviously a fellow Croatian, on the Goran backstory and his memories, well, first of all, of Goran's first Wimbledon final back in 1992.
I remember being in the refugee camp in Croatia watching that final and you know, being devastated, you know, seeing him losing that final because everybody felt he has it. You know, Andrej was not known as a grass court player. And if I remember correctly, I think Goran was favorite. And, you know, looking back now, everybody, you know, is kind of saying, you know, that was the most important moment of Goran's career, meaning that if he would have won that Wimbledon, that he would probably end up winning multiple slams. Of course, we cannot know that, but the fact is that I'm sure that it had a huge impact on Goran's career afterwards, and you know, him being so young, he was 21 only at the time. You know, I'm sure it scarred him for the rest of his career.
You say that you watched it in a Croatian refugee camp. Give us an idea of what Goran meant to people in Croatia back then.
He was one of those that you almost feel like he doesn't exist for real. You know, he was so far ahead anything we had in Croatia that I remember first time seeing him live. Alive, so not live, but like in person in 1995. I could, you know, it was a very emotional moment. You know, 92, you know, and that period, I mean, our country was in war, you know, so I'm sure that he felt the weight of the country on his shoulders because he was one of the rare sportsmen who were representing our young country and, you know, really showing that flag around the world.
Mm. And his story. And it ends so happily in 2001 at Wimbledon. But those years, I watched the 94 final. There was the 95 semi-final against Sampras. And then there was the 98 final when, and I don't think I've ever seen a player look as sad at a presentation as Goran did that day. And by then, I guess you would have known him because you were becoming a player. What were your memories about that journey and what he was going through?
Definitely the feeling was after that 98 final that it was kind of his last chance. He was playing great. He was playing well. I still remember that big beard that he had. And, you know, it was devastating, you know. And him, you know, having problems with that shoulder, that it was bigger and bigger. I think everybody kind of felt, okay, he's never going to get it, you know. So that blow that, you know, in 2001, I think absolutely nobody expected, you know. And if you will remember the incident that happened in Brighton in 2000, end of the year, where he had to retire because he didn't have any more rackets to play, I really thought, honestly, that that's the end of his career. He was 29, but, you know, you'll remember that back in those years, it was normal to retire, you know, at 30 or 31 or something. That was considered as an old age. So I felt like 2001 was kind of the last year of him, and that he was going to go around and play some tournaments. But definitely I didn't expect him to be, you know, competitive at the level that he ended up being. Mm.
And when he started the journey during Wimbledon, I mean, the players he was beating, I mean, it's kind of a nightmare draw when you look at the players he was going to have to play. When did you start to think this might actually happen?
Well, the thing about Goran and Wimbledon, it was never really about the opponents, you know, other than Sampras, you know, it was always about him. And I remember, you know, we spent some times early before the rounds. I would go to his apartment where he was staying. We would spend some time together, and then I lost quite early, so I left, I think, after the second or third round. And I remember him, you know, feeling good about his serve. You know, he really, like, he was feeling his serve great, you know, something clicked, you know, in a positive way. And he was enthusiastic about, you know, that Wimbledon. You know, he felt like, obviously, finally, no pressure in Wimbledon. He got a wild card. He's just happy to play. And his serve is working. And when I say his serve is working, I mean, that 30 ace is a max. So he was unplayable, you know. So it was definitely not... you know, it was not about the opponents, and he felt special. You know, he felt like something good can happen. Now, of course, now, you know, 20 years on, we talk about him winning that Wimbledon. I don't think he expected to win Wimbledon or even thought about it, but he did expect at some point, I think after second or third round, he did expect that he's going to play well. It's going to be very difficult to beat him.
It wasn't about the opponents. It was about Goran. That's such a pithy, perfect little bit of analysis, isn't it, from Ivan Ljubicic there. Lot to take in. You know, it's impossible for us to understand really what it's like for Goran and many other players from the Balkans to have spent their formative years in a war-torn country. You know, that's the case for Novak Djokovic as well as, you know, many other champions. And it certainly, that aspect is a big part of the Goran Ivanišević story.
It is, and we talked about it during the Agassi show a few days ago, the challenges that he faced trying to focus on tennis but also try to be the flag bearer for his country, both literally at the Olympics and in spirit throughout the world as he travelled around. And he was... such a passionate guy, and he could beat everybody. Okay, Agassi edged him, but he just couldn't get past Sampras. I mean, that's two finals and a semi-final at Wimbledon, and the 98 one, he really should have won that. He was the better player in most of it, to be honest. And as Ivan references, the big beard that he'd grown, and he'd got long hair and a headband, and he just looked, watching him stand there with the plate, as he called it. I don't want another plate. You know, he'd always talk about this. I just, my heart broke for him at that moment, and really never thought in a million years that he would ever win it after that moment.
It's like everyone talks about the rain in this tournament saving Goran and that kind of sense of destiny about it, but maybe Federer taking out Sampras was another really big helping hand in getting Goran finally over the line. You know, in the way we talk about, would Federer have a French Open if it weren't for Söderling? Well, would Goran have a Wimbledon if it wasn't for Federer taking out Sampras? I mean, it's just a big deal in this tournament. Sampras, you know, the big obstacle moving out the way.
Just to fill out the full backstory in case anyone's not aware of it, and Ivan Ljubicic alluded to a lot of it there, and he was ranked 125 in the world. He'd had to take a wild card from the All England Club in order to get direct entry to the main draw. And, you know, those things are all not ideal in terms of Goran's situation at the time. But there are low lows that his ranking doesn't quite tell you about. There's, you know, as Ivan Ljubicic said there was the tournament in Brighton where he got defaulted for having insufficient equipment after breaking all his rackets. There was his experience of losing in qualifying at the Australian Open less than 6 months before this Wimbledon. And I've heard him describe this as the lowest of the low points because he was scheduled on a court that he didn't know existed. And I don't know if he was exaggerating for comic effect, but he said that he got lost in a car park looking for the court. And I've heard him talk about, you know, being on the flight back from Australia after that chastening experience and thinking, I can't do this anymore, man. This isn't what being a professional tennis player is about.
Yeah, I think he said, I don't even feel like a professional tennis player doing this, giving me the getting my own balls and all this sort of thing. And even 2 weeks before, he came to Queen's and I was in charge of taking the players to their interviews, and he lost in the first round 6-3, 6-4 to Christian Caratti of Italy. And I brought him into the press conference after that. There were two people in there and he sat down. And he was laughing at his own total inability to beat people, his own tennis incompetence. And I mean, it was kind of sad, but also hilarious that this really great player, or at least, you know, at Wimbledon on grass, was going to Queen's on grass and losing to an Italian clay courter. And just looking finished, and it had become a joke amongst people. People weren't even turning up to his press conferences 2 weeks before he won Wimbledon.
Blimey, two people in a press conference. Oh.
And he found it funny as well.
I'm never sure who that's more awkward for, the player or the journalist.
Or the two people.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So he starts making his way through the Wimbledon draw, as does Pat Rafter on the other side of it. And we all remember the rain that year, don't we? It was, what, 8 years before they finally unveiled the centre court roof. We remember the rain most iconically as interfering with the semi-final between Goran Ivanišević and Tim Henman, a match that was played over the course of 3 days, the second Friday right through to what was supposed to be men's finals day on the Sunday. They played the women's final on that Sunday, Venus Williams getting the better of Justine Henin. And then the men's final, for just the second time in Open Era history, was due to rain to be played on the third Monday, the People's Monday, as it turned out, all the tickets being made available for sale on that Monday morning, 40 quid ahead. Completely unreserved seating, so it was just a bun fight when everyone got in the stadium to take their places. Queuing overnight for the tickets, obviously, demand far exceeded supply. And who was one of those people queuing for tickets? It was, well, our very own Charlie Eccleshare, no longer with The Telegraph, working for The Athletic now, but still very much engaged with tennis and friend of the pod. So Matt spoke to Charlie about his experience and, yeah, his memories of that incredible People's Monday.
Me, my brother and our friend Dan, we were watching it. We're like, well, we just got to go. We're never going to get this opportunity again. And so, yeah, we went over on the Sunday night and camped out. And it really was an amazing vibe that evening as well. Like, it, because everyone had taken this pretty spontaneous decision. No one there thought they were going to be watching the Wimbledon final come the end of the tournament. And loads of Aussies, loads of Croatians, and people from all over. And yeah, it did have that kind of festival feel to it. And yeah, just such, you know how the best things are the spontaneous ones you're not expecting. It was just like, I can't really believe we're here on Sunday evening and tomorrow for the first time in all of our lives. And the only time, I mean, I've been lucky, I've gone back, I've seen a Wimbledon final whilst working, but I've never gone back as a fan. So it did have that feel of like, we're never going to get through this again. Wow, I can't believe how lucky we are. So yeah, we kind of pitched up and yeah, just kind of prayed for sleep because we just really wanted to get to the Monday morning so we could get in and get our seats and get going.
So take me through those emotions on the Monday, and how did the ticketing work? You know, how were you assigned seats, do you remember, and where were your seats?
Yeah, well, this is one of like favorite memories from that day. Was you basically what they did, it was unreserved seating, so you got your ticket and then they opened the gates and it was first come first serve, and Dan, who we were with, he was like a champion sprinter, really really quick. And he would have been like 17, probably at the peak of his running abilities. And you know, bearing in mind, as Patrick Mouratoglou was talking about this week, tennis is famously has, you know, a slightly advanced watchership. And that was a younger audience at that final. But even so, we're Dan's competing with, you know, a lot of people twice, three times his age. And so as the gates are open, and we basically had told him, we decided what seat, exactly what seats we wanted. And we decided that basically midway, like more or less on the net, about 10 rows up, so dead central and opposite the umpire's side, because we thought the umpire's seat might be in the way. And we worked out where that was and basically just sent him on his way. So the gates open and like a shot, like the gun's been fired, off he goes. Gets us the exact seats we want. And it had that feel. I mean, the thing of like everything coming together. So there we are. So we've got the seats we want. There were a lot of Aussies around us. I don't know. I mean, we were so conflicted. I think everyone who went on that day was really conflicted. Even like the Aussies, you know, I don't think they begrudged necessarily Ivanisevic winning. And I think the Croatians or the Goran fans wouldn't begrudge Rafter winning that much. They're both just such likable characters. But yeah, so we're there. And I think it was a noon start. It was an early start because they were just obviously so desperate to finish and didn't want to take any chances. But yeah, so there we are and we're ready and just so excited. And it is, I mean, it's a cliche and you hear it a lot in relation to this final, it being kind of football atmosphere, but it did have that feel a bit. It didn't feel like a usual Wimbledon. It felt a bit like we were at someone else's house and they were out and we were just, you know, you know, the parents weren't there. They'd left us to our own devices and we could kind of just mess around a bit and, you know, make noise, a level of noise you weren't used to at Wimbledon final, or, you know, some of the rules just went. And I just love the fact that the players seemed to respond really well to that. And you could just feel that building and then they come out and we're ready to go.
How much do you think the fans impacted them? Because it strikes me that this match is the absolute antithesis of what we're going to be experiencing, certainly over the next few months, maybe longer, with events, tournaments behind closed doors. What did you learn about the connection between a player and a fan on that day?
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. I mean, certainly the way the match went, and the fact that whenever one person got up, the other came back. I do wonder how much that was affected by the rhythms of the crowd, because there probably was a degree to which fans like me, who, you know, weren't especially on one side, you know, we were kind of rooting for both men. I'm sure whoever was down at that time, we then would have supported them. And it's hard to know how much of a lift that would have given them, but it probably doesn't hurt when suddenly, you know, you feel you've really got everyone behind you, and that there was such a will for it to go to a fifth set. I think, I mean, you know, those matches you watch and you just feel from pretty early on that it's going to a fifth set. And I always wonder that. I wonder how much the players think that as well. But it did feel like we, and again, you know, I'm sure we kind of overestimate our importance to a degree, but yeah, it did feel like we were lifting whoever needed lifting. And so when Ivanisevic does have that kind of mini meltdown in the fourth set, there's a real will to get behind him, get him focused again, and, you know, lift him up so we can have the fifth set that we all want. But I mean, as well, the players talk about it afterwards, about the atmosphere and that kind of thing. And it doesn't feel like lip service. You know, I do think they were aware of how special and unique it was, and you know that it added something massive to the occasion, you know, making it so different.
And I guess there's a element here of it being center court, which is known for its hush, if you like, and the fact that suddenly you had this carnival atmosphere in that, I suppose that made it extra special as well. Had you had a centre court experience before that? I'm just wondering if that was your first centre court experience, how sort of unlike the norm that would be.
Yeah. I think I'd only been on centre court once before, maybe twice. But this did just feel like a totally different arena. And I think for them it probably did as well. You know, just because also you look at it and the colours and everything. Mm. You know, there are people in football shirts and all those like plastic kangaroos and all of this sort of thing. Like it does just feel. It looks to me a little bit like for London 2012 when they played at Wimbledon. So the branding was different and the colouring was different, and it was like it's Wimbledon, but it's slightly not. It kind of had that feel for me.
Yes, it's like Wimbledon on a trip.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You just slightly altered the settings a little bit.
And how do you look back on it now? Obviously, you've been to a lot of tennis, a lot of other sporting events since then. How does this one compare or stand out in terms of atmosphere and occasion?
I think one thing that always, for me, will make this so special is that it's really rare in sport or in life that you can say with any certainty that something won't happen again. But we can say, unless you know the roof is damaged or something like that, this will not happen again. We can categorically say there will not be a Monday final. There will not be a final that's open to the public, all things being equal. And I appreciate that we're in a global pandemic, so making predictions is maybe foolish, but... You know, that this shouldn't happen ever again. And that, to me, does always make it stand out, you know, that we were part of something that can't really be repeated. And it's so rare, I think, to think that with sport. So there is that uniqueness element to it. And I think the spontaneity of it as well, that it all just happened so quickly and that, you know, in the space within 24 hours, you're going from watching it on TV with no real sense of whether, you know, what the deal's going to be for the finals. And then suddenly you're there on center court. And it is, I do hold it really, really fondly. Like, you know, I've probably been to events with more like ferocious atmospheres. You know, I think of watching football in Eastern Europe and that kind of thing. But it is one of the occasions I remember most fondly. Like I don't know, because I don't know that many other people who are there. So it does feel like one of those things where, it's a little bit of a badge of honor. Like, yeah, I was at that. I mean, amongst tennis fans, I don't think anyone else really. I'm not sort of telling people I've just met that. And also I think because a lot of sporting events I've been to, either I've been working or I've gone as a fan. And often as a fan, you're too tense to really enjoy it because you know, you're so anxious. And unless the final, and they rarely are, is like a cakewalk, you're going to have moments of extreme nervousness and anxiety because you care so much. Whereas with this, you cared loads, but you weren't going to be like absolutely crushed if either weren't going to win. It was more you were just going to be delighted for the winner. So it you could just really enjoy it and embrace it. And it's one of those where it's just only positive memories, really.
I'm so pleased for you, Charlie, that you got to be part of one of the most special sporting occasions of all time that is certain to never be repeated, when my dad said, no, we can't go in queue overnight. Sorry, Kathy. I'm so pleased for you.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, being in Switzerland at the time.
And it's true, he does go around telling people that he was there because that's how we knew to speak to him for this.
Yeah, he says it's not the first thing he mentions in conversation, but it really doesn't sound like it, does it? Thank you to Charlie though for doing such a splendid job of recreating it, because when I started rewatching that match this morning, and you know, I've felt like I remembered it pretty vividly. it hit me like a wave, that atmosphere, when they walked out onto the court. It just was a cacophony. And it made me think, I know all the reasons why the quiet and the calm of centre court is celebrated. And I know it's a point of difference from the other slams. And I know I am in the minority here. Most people wouldn't want to change that permanently. But I just always want atmosphere. The more atmosphere, the better. And it just made me think, why can't we permanently get rid of the stuffy old posh people that populate centre court most of the time and bring in the plebs?
That is how the Guardian described it, I think, as kind of the plebs invading the summer palace. It has that kind of feel. And I think it's also so different from any other tennis crowd, not even just the Wimbledon crowd. You know, you've got even like the Davis Cup is amazing, but it's almost choreographed in a way, the Davis Cup atmosphere. They come with chants and instruments and they travel together, whereas this is so spontaneous and so reactive to the moment and genuine. And I think that's why it's important to speak to someone like Charlie, who was there, because as much as this was Goran's day and Rafter was such a big part of it, the atmosphere sits right alongside the tennis as to why this match is memorable. And everyone who was in the crowd that day played their part. And I just think generally they managed to turn an occasion, which, let's be honest, if most people who were probably watching or thinking about Wimbledon or certainly working at Wimbledon probably thought a Monday final was a massive irritation. It means change flights, changing your hotel bookings, you know, having to go on the extra day. And they've turned it into such a glorious occasion by what they did with the ticketing and, as you said, letting the plebs in. And, I mean, it's just so memorable for the reason of the fans.
Do you think the Daily Express are going to quote me on that tomorrow?
Without a question.
I include myself proudly in the pleb bracket, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We are plebs
we are
and proud.
Plebs and proud. So that was a flavour of the atmosphere, the experience of being there, just to give me a few moments to repress my bitterness and swallow it down.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to Amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's Amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right.
Let's hear from the two finalists, shall we? The two men that created that occasion and rose to it and made it one of the most special in tennis and sporting history. First of all, David's impromptu chat with the 2001 Wimbledon champion Goran Ivanišević this morning. And first of all, Goran talking about the night before the final and that giving him his first inkling of what might be in store for him the next day. And I must warn you, he does use some pretty fruity language.
When I went to return, because it was still these tapes to watch the movie, it was not CDs, but this VHS tapes. So I went to, and it was like a huge line already waiting for the ticket. So I saw the night before is going to be like interesting crowd, but then when I walked in, that was like unbelievable. I thought it's not Wimbledon. I thought I went to the wrong stadium.
How long did it take you to concentrate?
No, but I like this kind of atmosphere. It's just I was so happy that we could start that final. You know, I was really keen. So didn't bother me. It was really, really something that, you know, you really want for the atmosphere to be like that.
It's one of those things that I've watched the end of it loads of times, but I haven't watched all of it since. And I was watching the fourth set last night when you had the foot fault, and then you thought you'd hit an ace and you kicked the net and it starts to go crazy. I mean, how were you feeling in the fourth set?
Actually, I was not going crazy. I was more getting out of the system, you know. I'm not sure if that ball was wide or not, you know. The Hawkeye will be 100%, but, you know, that was close call. But, you know, I needed to kick the net to get because I was pretty calm all the time, you know. I didn't, so I was keeping everything. So I said to myself, okay, let it out, but you know, you can't fuck it up, you know. don't go too much crazy, you know, because this is your last fucking chance. So you don't. I was going crazy under control, which didn't happen so many times in my career. Let's put it that way.
Oh, that's so funny. And then you're in the fifth set and you finally break serve because I didn't realize you were 2 points from defeat. I didn't realize you were, what was it? Something like 5-all, love 30. And I didn't.
Yeah.
What was going through your mind at that point?
Well, actually, even in that stage, I didn't, you know, when you don't think you can't lose this match, you know, it's not happening. Because when you see the last game, I watched this last game recently. That's probably the worst fucking game ever in the history of tennis played by two players.
What, the 9-7 game?
Yeah, both of us. And especially in the finals of any Grand Slam. For sure the worst game ever. And only... why I won that game, because when you watch it closely, I could not play worse than I played, but he played fucking even worse, because if he played a little bit better, he would break me on zero. So actually he gave me that game. Actually, here, thank you, Goran, this is your time. It's a really terrible game. I mean, what I was doing, fuck, like I never went on the tennis court, but he was also terrible in that game, to be honest.
Apart from the one lob.
Okay, that lob was unbelievable. Actually, also my volley was not bad, deep, and that lob, but rest, terrible. I mean, he was missing some easy shots. I was doing double faults. I was catching the volleys that was going 10 meters wide. So we both kind of, he was actually, I think, shocked how bad I played the game. And then he was also like kind of playing bad, you know.
It was a race to the bottom.
Yeah, but really bad game. You know, usually, okay, you choke when it's last game, but this was terrible. I mean, terrible game, really bad game.
How were you feeling while it was going on?
I didn't have a clue how bad was that. after a couple of years, when you watch closely, you figure it out. Fuck, that's a terrible game. It's like, if there is a vote of the worst game ever in the history of tennis, for sure there will be one of the games up there in top five. Most important terrible game in the history of tennis.
and when his return at the end goes into the net, what goes through your mind?
Fucking put a serve in. Just put a serve just so he can miss maybe. or you know. So I was like, and he knew it, I'm going there. Because when I'm nervous, I'm going more to the tee than wide on that side. So he was there actually kind of, I don't know, pushed it and I was like, fucking finally, man. Finally you missed. Because I will probably miss.
Finally, somebody misses against you.
Finally, fucking somebody misses, because for sure if you put it back, I will miss. Or I will slip, because I didn't feel my legs. So for sure, some shit will happen on the way to the net.
Oh, well, you did it. Thank God. Right, well, we're speaking to him now, so we'll find out what he thought.
say hello to him.
David spoke to Goran this morning. He says hi.
He's an arsehole. Just tell him that.
He says hi, and you should go and work on your second serve. That's the message he has for you.
He's such a dickhead.
Do you have a broadcastable response to that, Pat?
I love Goran. I don't care. He can say whatever he wants. He's generally a lot meaner than that. So whatever Goran wants to say is all good by me. You got to laugh about it at the end of the day. But at the time, I had no laughter in me. And it's certainly when that final point went his way. So
you'd been in the final the previous year, lost out in four to Pete Sampras. Mm-hmm. Did you leave Wimbledon that year with a feeling of unfinished business?
I don't know. I don't ever say, oh, I need to come back and win it. I'm not that type. I'm not that good a player. You know, if Pete could come back or Andre could come back and say, yeah, you know, I'm going to go and I'm going to do it next year. They were good enough. I just hoped to be there next year. And Pete, I choked really badly against. I was probably in some ways closer to winning that Wimbledon than even Goran's match. I felt the pressure a lot more when I got up against Pete. And I was up first set, and in this tiebreak I was winning really easily and choked. But against Goran, I never really felt like I choked. I just probably misread the situation a little bit. But Goran was too good for me on the day. It just seemed to be Goran's. It was just destiny for him, the bugger. You know, he got me. He was too good.
You played that extraordinary semi-final against Agassi. What I remember about it is that you were never in the lead until the penultimate game, right? That was first on the Friday, and then Goran's match against Henman followed you, and obviously that ended up spanning over 3 days, and you got to put your feet up for those couple of days. How much of the Henman-Ivanisevic semi-final did you watch, and who were you rooting for?
It probably wasn't ideal for me to spend that much time just waiting. Generally, you like to keep the momentum going. So I can't remember how much of that I watched. It wasn't going to be really that relevant to me anyway. I sort of knew both players. And I was rooting for Goran, not because I like Goran better than Tim.
I'm a big fan of both of them, to be honest. I was going for Goran because I didn't want the English crowd also there just yelling at me. So it worked out the way I wanted it to work out, but the result obviously at the end didn't. And I don't know if it would have been any different if Timmy made it, you know. So I really don't know. Mm.
The final was billed as Goran's last chance for obvious reasons, 125 in the world, et cetera, et cetera. Did you feel like it was your last chance as well?
Well, I knew I was retiring anyway. I was done. So it was interesting when it came around the following year because I think Goran was injured or was taking a year off. I can't remember. And they asked me, you know, you're going to come back and play. And Roachie had spoken to me in May and said, come on, my Tony Roach, who was my coach, and said, come on, let's get ready and let's go back to Wimbledon. And obviously I didn't want to, but I said, well, let's see how I feel. So I went in there and we did 4 days of hard training back into it. And on the fifth day, I woke up and just said, Roachie, I'm not coming back in, matey. I'm done. I'm not going to get ready. I said I was retired and I really don't want to play anymore. And so Wimbledon, for the first time, I don't think had a men's finalist or final player opening the tournament up, which they traditionally used to do. So for me, I was done and I knew it was my last chance at Wimbledon.
And you knew that going into that Wimbledon 2001, you knew that going into the final?
Yeah, I couldn't wait to retire, to be honest. I love tennis. I got everything out of it. I tried, you know, to be the best player I could. And I always had in my mind that I wanted to leave tennis playing some good tennis. And I also wanted to get on with a different life. And the first year was tough when I retired. I saw the big matches and the big situations and big occasions and wished I was there. But after that, I was so glad I never went back to it.
People's Monday is something that we'll never see again at Wimbledon.
That's true.
Do you remember your first impressions when you walked out onto centre court that day and the cacophony of noise?
Yeah, I do really well. It was crazy. Even before the roof came on, we were trying to work out how this situation would ever get to be reenacted. And, you know, obviously having someone like a Tim Henman in the final on Monday, it wouldn't have been that type of crowd, that type of feeling, because it would have been so one-sided. It was split 50-50. The crowd was just yelling for the whole five sets. And I walked out in the court. It was mayhem. I remember winning the toss, electing to serve, and I hadn't calmed down my nerves. And I lost my opening serve, went on to lose the opening set. So I hadn't settled well at all. And probably should have readdressed that opening game, service game. But I do remember being incredibly nervous, like I'd never been nervous before. It was really an amazing atmosphere, and it was a terrific occasion for a pretty ordinary sort of match.
You say it was 50-50. I don't know, Pat. I've rewatched that match this morning, and you seem to have the majority of the support to me, certainly vocally. And, of course, you know, a lot more Aussies in London than Croats.
Yeah. Yeah, no, you're probably right. I don't know. I just felt like it was just bantering, going backwards and forwards. It was just singing the whole match, sitting on the side of the court just going, this is crazy. There's no quiet here. And it might have been the case. You're right. I don't know. I just remember it being loud, and I remember it not stopping. But listen, we went out and had a beer, a few too many beers at the end, and we all partied with the crowd, so it was a lot of fun.
You faced Pete in the final 1 year and Goran the next. How did mm-hmm. their serves compare?
To me, Pete's had the best ever serve that I've ever come across, and even to this day, I don't know if anyone serves as well as Pete does. It's like with Goran, if he hit it and I picked it right, I sort of was onto it. I felt okay hitting his serve back. But with Pete, even if I read his serve, his ball reacted quite differently off the court. It did a lot of action. There was a lot of spin on it, and it was heavy and it was strong. And it just felt like I never hit the middle of my racket returning Pete's serve, and found it very awkward to get on top of his serve. In fact, I never really did. You know, all the times we played. But Goran's serve is still, it was big and was fast, and you sort of just said, all right, let's just get it back and see what happens. And every now and then I did get it back. I just never felt that with Pete.
Goran said to David this morning that that last game of that final was the worst tennis, and this is a direct quote, the worst tennis that two players have ever played in the final of a Grand Slam. What do you think of that?
Well, I don't remember. I remember the whole match being pretty average. I'd had lost my serve, so I was pretty flat, to be honest. I was trying to find a way in that last game. Goran was choking. He was just playing the nerves, and I was just trying to get balls back, but I just felt I'd lost a lot of steam after losing my serve. And being so close a couple of games before, I was only 2 points away from the match, actually. So, it was close. It was tight. I felt deflated by the time that last game came around. And the only reason it went to a bit of a lengthy game was because Goran allowed it to happen that way.
It's obviously gutting, Pat, that you didn't win that match. But you're okay. In your own words, you're bloody fantastic, right? Goran maybe wouldn't be. If he hadn't won that match, does that offer you any comfort at all?
Yeah, listen, I'm really happy to help Goran out. Although, that's a really good question. Imagine if Goran wasn't. Let's just say, for instance, I'd won that match, and Goran was a basket case, and I was responsible for it at the end of the day. And the situation is that I'm okay. I'd won a couple of Grand Slams, so I'm okay with it. I've sort of got my little fix of tennis, and I'm doing okay. So, yeah, it's a tough one, isn't it? But, gee, that selfishness part of me wants that Wimbledon trophy. Gee, it would have been great to have.
How much do you think about that?
Not often. Every now and then a thought or a flashback might come in, and I'm very quick to just push it aside. Yeah, I think about the first 5 years, I was waking up in a cold sweat in the middle of the night, just reenacting or going through the last game at a game at 5-4 on his serve, and just thinking, I wish I'd picked this way, I wish I'd done that, I wish I'd done that, and that saved me for quite a while. And he sort of outsmarted me on a couple of big occasions. I had the wrong grip to make his return, and he came up with the right serve at the right time. He took a couple of big risks, actually. And, and that's, in hindsight, that's Goran. Goran's a pretty courageous sort of player, and he goes for it when the chips get down, and I probably should have read that a bit better.
How well did you know Goran before that match?
Pretty well. We'd played each other quite a bit in singles. We'd certainly had a few beers together over the years, and we played doubles together. And generally when you play doubles, you get to know someone's personality. But I always found it hard to read Goran because, I'd sort of come up to him, I'd serve, playing doubles and I'm serving. I'd say, all right, Goran, I'm going to serve down the middle. I want you to lean to this side, and then I'm going to fake, and we're going to do this, this, and this. I'd go through a bit of a structure. And when Goran would serve, he'd go, I serve forehand, I serve backhand. And there was nothing there. I said, and? It doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. And I was like, okay, all right. You serve forehand, I'll just sit there and wait to put a volley away, I guess. I got no idea. That was the end of his thought pattern. So I was well aware that he didn't really go through a big structure, which sort of helps in some ways because, you're pretty free to play a pretty loose game where, I had certain things which I tried to do and plan out, and certain players have worked really well against, but someone like Goran probably not quite so well.
How did your relationship change after that match, and what's it like when you see him now?
Yeah, it never changed. He's a classic because, it was a pretty moving moment for both of us, but he'll just sit there and he just literally give me shit. It's unreal. He'll just say, how are you feeling? He said, I won that. You know that? And it's just a classic, and it's just Goran. And I just sit there and laugh. And what else am I going to do? But the way he says it, it's just Goran. Remember the press conference he would go into, you never knew what was going to come out of his mouth, and you knew it was always going to be entertaining. And that was and I love Goran for that. So what am I going to do? I'm either going to cry or I'm going to laugh. And there's definitely a very funny side to it.
And can you bring yourself to be happy for him?
Yeah, I can. I can. Generally happy for Goran. If anyone was going to win outside of myself, it was Goran. I remember calling him up before one final. I reckon, did he make the final in 96? He might have played, can't remember, or 98 against Sampras maybe.
98 Sampras was his third,
Yeah. I remember ringing him up. I didn't get hold of him, left a message on his hotel phone saying, Goran, I'm really, really rooting for you. Good luck, mate. I hope you win. Goran and I were mates, but players generally didn't do that to each other. But I just felt like I wanted to do it. I think I was over in America playing a tournament or something like that at the time and was just really genuinely happy for Goran to do well. But, I mean, obviously, I wanted to win. But if there was ever going to be another winner, it was going to be him. And at the time, I've got to sort of deal with it. I'm not happy. And when we shook hands, it all looks like we're best buddies. But it was hurting. I was seething. It wasn't easy.
Last question for you, Pat. Tell me some more yes. about the drinks that were had that night. Were you out with Goran or just with the Aussie fans?
No, I don't think. I'm pretty sure I wasn't. I always put on a party regardless if I win or lose in a final, and we did that with Davis Cup as well. And we just celebrate, the whole occasion, the whole event. So we went to the dog. Went to the Dog and Fox. We had the area beside it. There was some place there, and it was on. Just all the Aussies that wanted to come in, you were free to come in. I remember Richard Branson was there. His son was there, and we had a few drinks, and we just sort of enjoyed the moment and just wanted to thank everyone for all their support throughout that time. It was my last Wimbledon as well. But, yeah, it's bittersweet as well. I mean, it was really touching. There were some really nice sentimental things said, but it was also very hard to take because you were the loser. It's always tastes better when you're winning those matches. But at the same time, I really try to emphasise with all the young kids that, you've done well, you've done great, you've put everything into it. You got to celebrate, what you've achieved here.
Oh, that's so nice. Pat, thank you so much. I'm sorry to make you relive all that. But I'm pleased fun. That...
Say good day to David as well.
Yeah, I will. I'm pleased that life's good. Stay well over there, right.
You too, Catherine.
The Dog and Fox Wimbledon Village has seen some things over the years, hasn't it? Could tell some tales.
Well, what a tale. What a conversation. I mean, it's just so interesting. I mean, I guess I knew bits and bobs of that. But we've spent some time with Pat and heard, and we know what a great guy he is, what a good fella he is. But to hear it in those terms and to properly get him regaling us with what it all meant to him, and the fact that it was reminds us that it was his final Wimbledon, that he wasn't intending to play anymore, and I've always seen that match through the eyes of Goran personally. I think probably because I knew him well, I'd followed his career, I'd seen all those losses in finals from over a 9-year period. So to me, it was about Goran, in his words, not ending up in a real state for the rest of his life. That's why I wanted Goran to win that final. But when you realise that Pat Rafter had been in the final the year before, he desperately wanted to win Wimbledon. It was bigger to him than any other tournament. And it was big in Australia. And he was going to end his career. So, you couldn't win and you couldn't lose. It was one of those.
Do you know what? Going into that chat, I think I underestimated the extent to which that loss hurt and still hurts for Pat Rafter, because most of the conversations I've witnessed with him talking about that match, Goran's been present for. And as he describes there, the dynamic is always Goran ribbing him and yeah. Pat just taking it and laughing. And you always get
just being a good sport.
Just being a great sport about it. And finding it in himself to be happy for Goran, because he's aware of that sliding doors of, how bad it could have been for Goran if he didn't win. But talking to him about it one-on-one there, and all of that is still the case. He's clearly genuinely happy for Goran. They clearly have a special relationship. Loveliest man in town, all of that. But there's an edge and a sadness to his voice, which I wasn't quite expecting, and I feel foolish for that now. You came 2 points away from from winning Wimbledon. He wanted to win Wimbledon more than anything, more than winning the Australian Open, he said. Yeah. And he was 2 points away and feels like he didn't perform to his best in the moment that really counted. So how could he not be? But it did really strike me this morning. It really did.
I also just wanted to remember as well that match in particular, I think, is we remember it because of the emotion and the atmosphere. It didn't showcase, as they make fun of, it didn't showcase their incredible talent. And when you consider the tennis that Rafta played to beat Agassi in the round before, when he was behind all the way through, broke back when Agassi's serving for the match, and he beat him the year before as well, and very nearly beat Sampras. He was a heck of a player, Pat Rafter. And Goran, his run to the title, went Carlos Moya, Greg Rozetsky, Andy Roddick, Marat Safin, Tim Henman, just to get to the final. And so he played incredibly that week as well.
I think Goran is amazing talking about that final game, but he doesn't do justice to how good Pat Rafter's lob is. on match point down. I mean, it's as much as I agree, it probably is one of the worst games in total. It also has one of the best shots in Grand Slam history. The juxtaposition of the calmness of Pat Rafter in that mind compared with the frenzy that's going on in the crowd and the frenzy that must be going on in Goran's mind and is going on in all of Goran's actions. I mean, I think he's been called Vesuvian, hasn't he, Goran? His emotions are always close, and there's, you know, he is in tears during the final game, certainly as soon as he wins. I've never seen a man collapse into tears so quickly, and
possibly it's Goran's dad.
But it's as much as that is a Goran game, like his mark is all over that game in terms of the way he's controlling it by hitting some terrible serves, followed by some brilliant serves when he needs it. It's also a very relatable final game. Like if I was serving for Wimbledon, I would be a mess. I wouldn't be able to hold my racket. I would be on the verge of tears. And I think it's what makes it so special, that as much as people can recognize that this is Goran's moment, they can also see themselves, I think, in Goran struggling and just praying for the ball, as he says, for Rafter to miss. You know, he needs some divine help to get him over that moment. And we've all been there in far, far lesser situations. And the fact that it's a Wimbledon final just elevates the tension and the drama and the moment.
I should apologise to anybody that didn't enjoy, well, Goran and Pat's colourful language, particularly Goran's, and definitely apologies to David's mum, who definitely won't have enjoyed it. And we did consider bleeping, didn't we? But it tells a story in itself, doesn't it, Goran's use and choice of language? So we have elected to leave it in and carry an explicit tag for today. So thank you, Goran, for that. And Pat as well. We've got one last bit of insight for you. I said that David watched that match from the players' lounge in Gstaad, and you got a sense, David, of the sentimental feeling that the players even had towards Goran Ivanišević and his will to win Wimbledon. And of course, that had nothing to do with negative feeling towards Pat Rafter, because no one in the history of time has ever had a negative feeling towards Pat Rafter. He's just that kind of guy. But it goes without saying, I think, that it was a win that was popular with the other players. And here is Ivan Ljubicic recalling that experience of watching in Gstaad.
Everybody was watching in the player lounge. Everybody was watching that final because it was extremely emotional. And two most liked guys on tour, you know. I think most of the people still, you know, hoped and cheered for Goran to win because he didn't have one. And Rafter came, you know, he was coming from winning US Open 97, 98. So he had his lamps, you know. But it was extremely emotional. I mean, I remember crying like every single person in our country when he finally did it, you know. And it was an incredible moment. And the day after, I actually played Roger Federer first round in Gstaad, and him beating Sampras that year, he was just about to become, you know, one of you know, what we know today. He was playing great, and I actually beat Roger 6-2, 6-1 the day after Goran won Wimbledon. This is how much how inspired I was after that win, and how much Roger wasn't inspired after beating Sampras and losing to Henman in quarters. So it was extremely emotional. I actually remember having Goran's photo in my wallet for some time, you know, until I think the end of that year, because he really inspired me. And it was something that went beyond just a tennis match or a tennis tournament.
Yeah, I looked up your results in Gstaad that week because I was curious how you'd done, and I saw that you'd got this 2-1 or 1-2 win over Roger, and I wondered whether Roger wasn't. I mean, I'm not trying to be disrespectful. I wonder whether Roger wasn't fit, but you said it was. You genuinely felt different because of seeing Goran.
Yes, I mean, I was very inspired. I mean, Roger lost quarters in Wimbledon, so let's calculate that might have been like Wednesday, maybe, or maybe because of the rain a little later, maybe Thursday. So he didn't have a lot of time to get ready for clay courts in altitude in Gstaad. So obviously he really didn't play a good match. And I remember actually people whistling him coming when he was coming off the court, and me kind of trying to tell the crowd to be kind of nice to him because he's going to be a great champion. And it's surreal actually now looking forward, you know, everything that happened. But I mean, it was a quick match. I don't think I think it was less than an hour.
Yeah. Well, at least it gives you something to remind Roger about if ever he gets too big for his
boots. Don't worry about that. I'm reminding him every day almost. So it's one of his worst losses in his career.
I love the idea of being inspired by a fellow sports person to the extent that you carry a picture of them in your wallet. That's really tickled me. Have you got a picture of Alexander Mitrovic in your wallet, Matt?
No, I do have a Fulham calendar still, you know, which people have when they're about 8. I still have mine, and he's on my bedroom wall. But no, I mean, that is amazing, isn't it? Just carrying around with him all year in his heart.
Who would you have in your wallet, David?
Oh, I mean, I could do with a separate wallet for all the pictures that could inspire me.
Possibly Goran. But I mean, that really got to you, didn't it? Watching it. I mean, you've watched those final games twice in the last 24 hours.
Yeah. No question. I think I could watch it on a loop and it would get me every time from the atmosphere itself, which does, as you said, it hits you like a wave. You can't quite believe what you're experiencing, to the look on his face and the clear signs of what he's going through, trying to get over this line that just seems that it's always just a little bit out of reach. And I remember, first of all, being in the player lounge, and the reason I called Ljubicic for this interview and asked him for it is because I remember him sitting there with his wife, sobbing uncontrollably all the way through the final game, all the way through those juices and advantages. He was in tears the whole time. And by the end of it, he'd got his hands in front of his eyes. He could not watch. He just wanted somebody to tell him whether Goran had won or not. And the rest of the room, and his wife was there with him feeling exactly the same, and the rest of the room were mostly cheering for Goran because they were worried about him and they knew what he'd gone through. And then there's a few people that were cheering for Pat Rafter. And then everybody was saying, Goran, serve out wide. So, you know, all this shouting at the TV. And yes, I do remember the next day being on the court when Ljubicic beat Federer for the loss of three games and the crowd whistling Federer off. It was really uncomfortable to witness. And yeah, Ljubicic just jumped to his defence immediately in the on-court interview and just asked them to be nice to him.
Those scenes of presumably been erased from Switzerland's tennis archive the day they booed Roger Federer. I mean, no one's got that footage, have they?
Oh, wow.
It's out there somewhere. Everything's out there somewhere.
Well, that was 2001, folks. We've dwelled on it a while, and frankly, we could also, and we debated covering Ivanisevic Henman from 2001 as well. I mean, we really could have stayed a long time, even longer in that year, because it was, particularly on the men's side, absolutely epic. And it's been a pleasure to be there for a couple of days. And yeah, what a way to commemorate that most extraordinary of finals, to get to speak to the people that we've spoken to today. I'm chuffed a bit. But alas, the train rolls on, and its next destination, Matt, is
2004 and the women's final, the root of the unrivalry, Maria Sharapova beating Serena Williams.
And David, you've spoken to
the man that was coaching Maria Sharapova for many years, Michael Joyce, who has some fascinating stories about the player she was back then, the person she was back then, and the player and person she went on to become. Really, really interesting conversation with him.
I can't wait. You've got 24 hours till then, David. You can go back and watch 2001 final on a loop until then, if you like.
I would happily watch it every day, I think.
Or you can do a load of homeschooling and make some lunch. It's been a pleasure. It's been an absolute pleasure to cover that final in that detail. And we still got 5 more of these things to go. So let's go and take a deep breath, get some rest, and come back and do it all tomorrow. We'll see you then.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.